This is Radio Freethinker, episode 99.
To Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course, also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and also executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. You know, Ethan, this week, my faith in humanity was shaken yet again. You may remember that we've done a few episodes about the Middle East, in particular Israel and all that, and one of the recurring themes in that was the UN would come and say, oh, Israel has done a bad thing. Israel would come back and say, oh, the UN is controlled by Arab-loving anti-Semites or whatever. Well, recently, the government in Lebanon collapsed. And do you know why it collapsed?
Why?
It collapsed because Hezbollah, which is one of the major political parties in that country, withdrew its support for the government because the UN was going to come out with a report saying that Hezbollah was somehow responsible or partly responsible for the death of its prime minister. So what did Hezbollah say? The very same group that has cheered the UN for its condemnation of Israel and said that it's above reproach, these are honest reports, you should always trust the UN, it's a great thing. It said the UN is controlled by Americans and Zionist, and that it was just a bunch of poop. And they brought down the government. I'm going, oh, guys, you know, you were doing so good in some senses of the term, right? You were supporting the UN. You're saying, okay, it's unbiased. And in order to support something that you think is unbiased, you need to support it when it comes against you, just not always when it's for you. Otherwise, really, are you much different than your those people you oppose? And
well, I mean, be consistent at the very least.
Exactly.
You know, the UN is obviously controlled by somebody. Let's keep that person in place for a few years.
And we all know it's the Raelians.
The Raelians, yes.
The lizard people from outer space.
Those lizard people are up to no good.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So, but, you know, speaking of being shocked to the core, we're here yet again. Daniel is busy doing something that he thinks is more important than Radio Freethinker. Chloe, who we had on for a while, seems to be a no-show for the rest of the year. We need something. We need something more. Do you have any suggestions, Ethan?
Well, you know, I think that we need to appeal to the listeners of Radio Freethinker and appeal to their sense and their love of skepticism. Because, you know, let's face it, Don, you like skepticism, right?
Yes. Now, I was going to do the joke, but I didn't do the joke, and if you know the joke, you're my kind of people.
Great. But you know what? You also like radio, right?
Oh, I love radio.
And if you like skepticism and you like radio, then why not be on Radio Freethinker? Yes, if you have something you want to talk about, if you're a fan of talking about skepticism or critical thinking, or you have a story idea, or you just kind of want to be here and, you know, see how it goes, email us, radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We're always interested to hear from the listener, and you know what? We have an empty chair here. If somebody wants to come and join us and discuss something interesting that's happening in the news, or sink your teeth into a nice meaty topic about, I don't know, censorship or land ownership or who knows what.
Exactly. There's lots of people out there we know, because we do get a lot of feedback, some from email, some from personal encounters, who like the show, who like, you know, some of the things we got, and they say, oh, but you know, you really should cover this. Oh, you really should cover this. Well, you know, this is kind of an open casting call if you're interested. Now, you don't have to sign on for the whole year, right? I mean, if you just want to come on, you got some segment that you think would be interesting to do, and you're willing to help us do it, please do. If you, like I say, show ideas, who knows where it could go from. This, you're not making a big commitment, but hell, it can be lots of fun. Just sure. Come on out and let us know, and we can see what we're going to do. Otherwise, me and Ethan might just kill each other.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's hard to bottle the rage that me and Don feel for each other on a regular basis.
We don't have rage. This is called dynamic tension. It leads to the excitement that is the show, the ping in our voices.
Sure. But, you know, speaking of rage, I hear that the Catholic Church is really got an interest in one of their past popes.
Well, you know, this is all prefaced on the idea that Pope John Paul II, when he was pope, loved saints. He thought saints ginned up the troops, that it was good for morale. And under his reign, there were more saints created in the Catholic Church than had done by all previous popes in history. Please check that out. I'm 98% sure that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, I was reading an article by Michael Kinsley, who did really, really good. And I'm going to sort of paraphrase most of his articles. And I just liked what it was. Now, it was titled, Don't Let Miracles Trump Science. The Roman Catholic Church has either a good sense of humor or a bad sense of humor. The Vatican has announced that the late Pope John Paul II will be beatified on May 1st. Beatification is sort of halfway house on the way to sainthood. The fastest beatification in record, actually. 6 years from his death to the finish, edging out the previous record holder. Ethan, do you know who the previous record holder was?
Mother Teresa?
Of course. Who, of course, was made famous by Christopher Hitchens, because she wasn't famous before then. By a few days, Pope Benedict the 14th waived the traditional requirement of the 5-year waiting period before starting the process. Bang, right out of the gate. But he couldn't waive the other main requirement for beatification. That was one certified miracle performed by the would-be saint. Now, to be saint, you need to have two miracles. Apparently, he cured a French nun of Parkinson's disease. I bet you thought Parkinson's was an incurable disease. Well, apparently not, if you know whom to pray to. There is no way to diagnose Parkinson's for sure. It's just by basically eliminating the other alternatives, whatever's left is diagnosed as Parkinson's disease. Now, the actual accuracy of the evaluation based on autopsies after people are dead are about 75 to 90%. So, and even if you do say you have Parkinson's disease, there's a significant chance you may not actually have it. But according to Associated Press, Vatican-appointed doctors determined that her cure had no scientific explanation. That sounds bad, doesn't it? But no, it's actually good, because if there's no scientific explanation, there must be an unscientific reason for it. In other words, a miracle.
Are you sure she didn't use homeopathy?
More on that later. But as far as the church is concerned, one down, one to go. There's nothing there's nothing like scientific explanation to spoil everything. So they're all happy that this is a mysterious disease, was cured mysteriously, therefore the only possible explanation was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the real world, Parkinson's disease can actually be cured through stem cell research, or at least there's a lot of hope to be done through that. Research, of course, that the miracle-loving Catholic Church is against and regularly lobbies countries all around the world to not do it. Why? Because, based on their medieval idea of what a human is, it is created at the time of conception when they are granted, according to the Church, a soul. Now, there's real discussion that can be made as far as how we use stem cells and at what point, you know, a person becomes a real person. But one of the things that's a classic test that's used against people according to the church or anyone in general, is suppose there was a fire in your house and that you had a choice of either rescuing a one-year-old baby or two test tube babies, which one would you do? Of course, for the Catholic Church, there's no question. They would rescue the test tube babies because that's saving two souls, whereas you're just losing one. And of course, this is what the Pope would probably say if he was here to speak to us. So it seems a little unfair maybe that Pope John Paul II would use his first miracle coupon to help an aged nun and leave the rest of us hanging out to dry. But he has one more miracle left, and maybe, just maybe, his second miracle will be an actual cure for everyone for Parkinson's. Now, that was basically the article. I've added a bit here and there, but I just thought that was such a great way to put up how wackadoodle miracles are and how misdirected it is. I mean, what are real miracles? Well, real miracles are like a single mom with 10 kids who somehow managed to keep them alive and get them good jobs. That's a miracle. That's miraculous. Mm-hmm. But to cure someone who prayed to a saint, a supposed saint, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I know it's a complicated issue, but wasn't one of the commandments not to worship idols or anything? And if you're kind of worshiping the Pope, saying, hey, Pope, can you do me a favor and you'll be number one in my books?
You're a Lutheran.
I don't know. It just struck me as kind of odd. But I love the article. It showed up in several different newspapers under different titles, but the words were quite the same. But the Pope, John Paul II, post-Pope, dead Pope, may soon become a saint, and he will have all the superpowers that all saints have.
Well, you know, I always find it very strange how people seem to have rose-tinted glasses when they look at the previous Pope. I mean, let's not forget, this guy was not innocent, and the Catholic Church is...
No, Pope Innocent was during World War II, I think.
Yeah, that's funny. This guy was very front and center as well in a lot of the things that we've been throwing on the feet of Benedict. And, you know, he's the one who installed him as the prefect of the Doctrine of the Faith or whatever it was. And he's just as culpable of any of them for the neglect and the ongoing abuse of children in the Catholic Church, and the myriad of other issues that have plagued the Church, like, not promoting condoms in AIDS-ridden countries, or, you know, enforcing serious human rights violations like corporal punishment in various countries, that sort of thing.
Well, you have to remember, I mean, the Pope does have the last word when it comes to the creation of bishops and all that around the world. And again, we hear a lot of them now, you know, who say, well, condoms cause AIDS, that, you know, the pedophilia whole issue. And this was sort of the buck stops here guy. Mm-hmm. But now it's like, actually, that was the other thing I was thinking about when I was listening to all this stuff going on. And if you pray or you ask for the interdiction of an individual and a miracle occurs, then you're beatified and then you become a saint. So, and I hate to use the guys, but for the point, if somebody prayed to Hitler and a certifiable miracle occurred, does that sort of wash away everything he did while he was alive? And because, I mean, if it's a miracle and it's a certified miracle and the person swears to God, for lack of a better term, that was the person who they asked for interdiction, are there rules around that? Or,
well, like you said, I think that the Pope can just sort of make up any rule he wants, and poof, somehow, lots of hand-wringing aside, they've figured out some way of getting around it. Personally, I just think that the whole notion of turning the previous Pope into a saint is, I mean, well, it's ridiculous on one level, but I think it's really glossing over the misery that happened under the reign of this Pope and the current Pope towards millions of people around the world. So, yeah. But moving on from the misery of the people of the Catholic Church to misery that we can all share and enjoy, a new report has been issued entitled Global Food and Farming Futures, led by Professor John Beddington, who is the British government's chief science advisor, suggesting that the world governments must take action to change the dietary habits, cut waste, reduce subsidies, and embrace genetically modified food, or we are going to be facing a global catastrophe.
Oh, no.
That's right.
That's news to us.
Yeah. The report is the culmination of a 2-year study involving 400 experts from 35 countries, and is the first study across a range of disciplines deemed to have put such fears on a firm analytical footing. Based on the figures that the world population will reach 9 billion with a B, in 40 years, the report and researchers are arguing that radical changes are necessary to accommodate this number. And the changes are going to be very widespread based on the fact that the current situation is completely inadequate to feed only 6 billion people. To quote Professor Beddington, urgent change is required throughout the food system to bring sustainability, center stage, and end hunger. It is also vital for other areas such as climate change, mitigation, conflict, and economic growth. So the results of not adapting to this growing population is very hazardous, as the report suggests. As hunger spreads and migration and conflict will rise in proportion, economic growth will suffer as a result. And this is sort of the same argument that we saw being made with climate change. It wasn't just a matter of, you know, it's going to get warm, but there's going to be all these additional effects that are going to have really disastrous consequences if something is not done. The interesting thing about this report also is that they really pointed to that this is not an isolated instance of just food shortage. This is related to technology when it comes to genetically modified food. We can't just throw that aside because of moral or ethical concerns. We need to look at new ways to produce agriculture. We need to look at climate change and its effect on food production. And this is all, you know, incredibly important right now because, as we say, population is rising, and we don't have the resources necessary to feed the population right now. So this report is turning some heads. They've suggested a few ways of fixing the problem, namely that food and agriculture need to be a political hot-button issue right now. Genuine public debate needs to play a critical role in making this problem front and center. That's what the report is suggesting. They also point out that since 925 million people suffer from hunger and perhaps a further billion lack malnutrition, the food system is not working for the majority of people who need it the most. So these people who are suffering right now, they need a lot more political clout when it comes to getting their needs heard by the community. And another major problem that they pointed out was that there are about a billion people right now who overeat and are therefore obese. So not only do you have people starving to death, you have people who are overeating and further hampering the healthcare system that's trying to provide for people. So major problems around the board. We need to start thinking into this right now.
You know, it was funny. When this article was first brought to my attention, it was put by the British government, which, as we all right know, is headed largely by a conservative government, although it's a coalition. So the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to go to it. I'm going to reach, oh, this has got to be political propaganda because it's done by a government agency. And I looked really, 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 really hard into this, and I was trying to find something. And I did find a few things. I mean, they mentioned that, you know, you need to have much stronger property rights and that we need more free market to prevent all that. But by and large, it wasn't that bad, but there was a lot of data. And actually, that was one of the things that I thought was quite impressive. Ethan was mentioning that actually this report itself is more of a meta report, because if you look in it behind this report, and if you go to their website, which I guess we'll have on our notes page, there's actually dozens and dozens of other reports that all this information came from. Some of the things that they mentioned, which I thought were quite interesting, people you don't really think about, they talk about things like infrastructure. Now, in a lot of developing countries, when they talk about infrastructure, you have a lot of poor people who have land, but they can grow crops, but there's no way to actually get that crop into the cities where it's actually needed. And as we have a more and more urbanized population, that becomes interesting. So when they sit there and they say you need to expand markets, one of the things that they talk about is this idea of just building roads or building means of doing that. Locally, we have this whole idea of local food. And, I mean, it's easy for us to have this idea because we have a well-developed network of roads and that. But in a lot of the world, that sort of thing doesn't exist. You also mentioned, which I thought was good, because they covered about the whole idea of genetically modified foods. And, I mean, they acknowledge that there's a lot of cultural pressure against genetically modified food, in spite of the fact that the vast majority of GM food has a significant amount of evidence showing that it has next to or no effect at all in the population, that there is a learning curve to be done, but the biggest thing is just to get the people to accept the idea that genetically modified food is good. We just need to improve the regulatory mechanisms behind it.
And get the technology up to speed. There's been so much countermeasures against it that it's really starting to lag behind.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and actually that's something that I'm going to get to a little bit later. But another thing, too, that I thought was interesting is they talked strongly against the idea of self-sufficiency, which we talked here before about Gwen Dwyer was talking about Lifeboat Britain, which was a big thing about, you know, being self-sufficient in your food production. And they said, no, anyone who even thinks of that is probably going to go down the wayside. And the idea of stability. I didn't like how they ruled out market speculators as far as rising food cost. And that's something I think I would look at more about. But I think my biggest fault with this, outside of being something to get people motivated to say, hey, we need to do something, is really all its recommendations are we need to invest in technology, we need to worry about climate change and do something about climate change. There's very little specifics onto what to do, sure. But a lot of, you know, we need to do something, which I guess has its place.
I mean, keep in mind, though, that this is going to be a cross-discipline solution. It's not just going to be like you walk into the food production factory and say, okay, you do things differently now. It's going to be something that has to encompass many different fields of science, technology, and politics as well.
And with luck, it will become the official policy of the British government, it being sponsored by the British government. And once one nation buys into something especially a major nation like England, then hopefully other countries will follow suit.
Exactly. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
So he hid it. And one place he knew he could hide something is
CITR.
5 long years he wore this watch. Up his
CITR.
Then he died of dysentery. He gave me the watch. I hid this uncomfortable hunk of metal up my
CITR.
2 years. Then, after 7 years, I was sent home to my family. And now, little man, I give the watch to you.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
We're back on a Radio Free Thinker. So what's this I hear about dinosaurs?
Eggs. What did you have for breakfast, Ethan? Did you have eggs for breakfast?
I did not, no.
Oh, well, you know, eggs are a big topic now, apparently, in the paleontological circles. We often have issues when we try and elicit behavior on ancient fossilized type animals because, well, they're bones and it's very hard to tell anything much about a bone as far as what it does or whatever. But apparently, sometimes fate, nature, Darwin works out for us. Apparently, they found a plesiosaurus, a dinosaur, a Darwinopterus, as in named after Darwin.
Okay.
With a preserved egg, and it was recently found in northern China. Now, what makes this such an interesting thing is the position of the egg relative to the hips of the adult. One of the things you often have difficulty doing in paleontology is determine things like gender. There's been a huge controversy lately as to how many actual species of dinosaurs we've discovered, because some people have said, well, either the dinosaur is the female version or the male version of this dinosaur, or it's a juvenile versus an adult. So there may be actually a lot fewer species of dinosaurs in the past. But this particular one, which has other recognizable characteristics, they've actually been able to determine that there's actually a very huge dimorphism between male and female. As I say, they discovered this plesiosaurus with an egg right around its hips, right where you would expect it to be if it was pregnant with an egg, which allowed, of course, the researchers to say with a certain degree of confidence that it was a female, or perhaps a seahorse, because male seahorses have eggs. But
sure.
One of the things that they also noticed, this female did not have a huge head crest. So, like I say, one of the big debates were, are the head-crested versions the same animal, or is it a female-male diversity? And they said, well, hey, it looks like we have now proof that this was a female, it is of the species, and that the males just grow a huge crest later, kind of like deers and antlers and that sort of thing. Another weird thing that I just, and I, it's amazing what you can pick up in news stories that have absolutely nothing to do, but one of the huge differences between bird eggs and lizard eggs is the permeability of the eggs themselves. So bird eggs are hard shells, as we all sort of know, especially if you've had breakfast recently. And one of the things about the hard shell is it's tougher, so it's more protective, but it's also impermeable. So everything that the embryo needs has to be in the egg. Anything that's not in there, it can't use. And one of the things is water. And water takes up a lot of space. Well, apparently, at least in the plesiosaurus, a number of reptilian eggs, is it's permeable. So it actually is much smaller. It doesn't, and it will absorb moisture from the surrounding environment in order to live off of that. And that's one of the evolutionary divergences between bird eggs and lizard eggs. I went, wow, I didn't know that. I'm so glad we had plesiosauruses. Otherwise, I may never have known that interesting little fact.
That's true.
Do you like eggs?
They're okay.
I think we started off with that.
Okay.
Well, now that we're heading down this road, everyone brace yourself for an intellectual whiplash, because now we're going to talk about, a little bit, about Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who, sadly or happily, depending on your sitting on the spectrum of politics, celebrated his fifth year as Prime Minister of Canada.
That's right.
Ironically enough, known as one of the most successful minority leaders in Canadian history, beating out Lester B. Pearson. Of course, the way they handled each other's political careers are quite different, but that's for a different show. But recently, he's been noted to say that he's planning to try and scrap the $2 vote subsidy that parties get. And he says, and I quote, these parties, which make no effort to raise money whatsoever, are not acceptable to Canadian taxpayers. There are already generous credits and incentives in a tax system to encourage people to give to both political parties. So, and now I'm paraphrasing, screw it. If you don't have rich donors, you don't deserve to be a political party in this country. Then I discovered a lot about how this little political donation system works. Now, when an election is held, political parties get $2 for every vote that was cast in the previous election, provided they reach a 2% minimum of votes cast. Now, this money, of course, is used to help pay for staff and offices in between elections and to do research and political campaigning before that. This was actually quite a recent law, actually. It was only passed in 2003. And it was sort of a compromise because in 2003, what they did is they banned contributions from corporations and, I believe, political unions. Labor unions as well.
Right.
So this was sort of a give me. And ironically enough, the people who are going to lose out the most for this are going to be the Tories, because apparently they get $10.4 million a year from this. The Liberals get 7.3, the NDP 5, the Bloc a little under 3, and even the Green Party, because they did so well in the last election, got $1.9 million annually for this. Now you're saying, well, how is this really a skeptical issue? Well, one of the things that often comes up on our show is, you know, the whole idea of political skepticism, that people need to be engaged and informed. And one of the ways that you get informed is you have a diversity of voices out there that tell you their particular point of view and their angle in particular articles, and you're not getting the single monotone, this is the way it is, this is the way it is, this way it is. By having government funding of political parties, one of the things you get is you increase that diversity. You actually allow parties to be more intuitive and more reflective to the population in general. And like I say, I think I would fear that the only political voices that I can hear are those that have big wallets. And we've had a lot of history of that. And right now, if we look to the South, we see how the American political system is really starting to suffer, and the next election is going to be humongous. I hear that Barack Obama's re-election campaign is going to cost over $1 billion. And that's not going to come from small campaign donors. That's going to come from the people who have benefited from political favoritism. That was one of the reasons why they wanted to make this amendment to make government parties at least partially funded by the people, so that these big interests, the big pharma, the big homeopathy, don't have the same kind of influence that they could have in a purely for-profit political system.
Well, definitely, actually, I think that is a very good point and needs to be addressed. You know, we're going to actually discuss a little bit about that. In our next coming segment, we have an interview with Erica Johnson of the CBC, who hosted the now infamous Marketplace episode.
You know, and actually that it ties in very directly, because the CBC is a government-funded news agency that can go out and do things that are not necessarily profit motive, because it's the truth or it's in the public interest. And I really am looking forward to what she has to say about the whole controversy of the homeopathy and maybe Marketplace in general.
Right, and you'll hear the interview after this commercial break.
We got a theory.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We know how magnets work.
That's right. If magic is all we've ever known, then it's easy to miss what really goes on. But I've seen miracles in every way, and I see miracles every day.
Yo, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is one of the hosts of CBC Marketplace, Erica Johnson. Erica, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Ethan.
So tell us, how did Marketplace decide to do a show on homeopathy?
Well, you know, we get most of our show ideas from viewers, but in this case, I was actually in a store, and I kept noticing these remedies, these homeopathic medicines on the shelves, and I looked at a couple of them, and they had drug identification numbers from Health Canada, and so every week we have story meetings on the show, and I said, hey, I don't know anything about homeopathic medicine. It might be interesting to look at it and see what it's all about, how it works, and so on. So when we first put this on our list of possible stories for the season, we really didn't know much about it. How did it differ from naturopathy and so on? It was really just an exploration of something that we had started to notice increasingly.
And were you skeptical to begin with, or did you think there must be something to this?
Honestly, I didn't know enough about homeopathy to be skeptical about it. It was really, from the beginning, let's find out what it is. As the research progressed and we learned about some of the fundamental principles behind homeopathy, yes, we did become skeptical about some of the claims of its effectiveness and so on. But no, initially, very open-minded about it, and we just wanted to learn more about it.
And did that skepticism encourage you to seek out the skeptical movement, so to speak?
Well, you know, the way we got in touch with your organization was just Googling around to see what had been written and what people were saying about homeopathy. And we came across an article that you had written discussing a Vancouver homeopath. And the homeopath, we went to her website and looked, she had been in business for quite a long time, a very experienced homeopath. And you had a lot of concerns about that. And so initially, We thought, wouldn't it be interesting to talk to your organization and then also to speak to this Vancouver homeopath? But, and in fact, we lined up an interview with her, and the morning of the interview, she canceled on us. So we didn't have her, but we did have you, and we started seeking out other homeopaths.
I bet alert listeners can guess who that homeopath was. You mentioned trying to track down homeopaths. Was that a difficult process? I mean, this one said no. Did other ones, were other ones eager to go on camera and talk to you?
Well, that was what was so interesting. No, you know, the researcher who was assigned to this story, a senior researcher, said that she had not experienced something like this before, where people were very hesitant to talk about something that they were happily practicing. And, you know, she would call up and say, we're from CBC's Investigative Consumer Show Marketplace, just would like to hear a bit more about homeopathy, how you think it works, why you think it works, what your experience has been with patients. And a sort of silence would come over the phone. And a couple of times the researcher said, I wasn't even sure if they were still on the other line. And there was a very big hesitancy, not just from independent homeopaths, but from larger organizations that we contacted as well. You saw in our story that we wanted to talk to the Ontario Homeopathy Association and other groups as well. And they just flat out said no. And in fact, one organization said, well, we know your show and you're going to ask us how homeopathy works. And that's a gotcha question. And so the researcher said, why is that a gotcha question? If you're practicing homeopathy, surely you can explain how it works. But no, they didn't want to do that. So it was very difficult, actually, to get people to come on camera.
Did you seek out anyone from Health Canada and ask them about their role regarding policy on homeopathy?
Yeah, we did, because as I mentioned, these homeopathic medicines are all labeled with drug identification numbers. So we wondered, after we did some testing and discovered that the over-the-counter products we tested were basically sugar pills, how they would come to have a drug identification number. So yes, we asked Health Canada for an interview, and they declined. They responded only in email and said they wouldn't do an interview with us. And their explanation for how homeopathic remedies received drug identification numbers was in our piece, that it's based on these pharmacopoeias that are based on what are called provings within the homeopathic community. I don't know if you're familiar with that or would like me to explain a little bit about that, but it seemed surprising to us that would earn a homeopathic medicine a drug identification number.
Definitely. When was the CBC aware that this episode would become very controversial?
You know, we did not realize to the extent of how controversial it was until about, I would say, a month or so into it. As our researcher and producer and I made more and more calls, we started noticing that people knew that we had already called so-and-so across the country, or that we had contacted a scientist in the United States. Or so we became aware that people within the homeopathic community were definitely talking about our story, and we started getting emails from various members of the homeopathic community saying, it's come to our attention, you're working on this story, and we hope that you take an open approach to this, and that you you know, include all of the many studies that have been done proving homeopathy works, et cetera, et cetera. And so with several people, we did ask them to send us studies, and we said, you know, send us your top 10 studies, anything you can send us that will prove that what you're practicing has some scientific validity to it. And they did send us studies. The problem was, when we had them analyzed by experts, scientists, chemists, medical doctors, and so on, they were found to have scientific flaws. I mean, some of the things you could, even a layperson would be able to tell that the science was so bad. It wasn't a clinical trial. They were calling it a clinical trial, but it would be an observational study. A homeopath who observed things happening with his patients, and that turned into a study. Well, as you know, that doesn't stand the test of good science. And so, unfortunately, we were never provided any studies that were convincing.
Definitely very, very telling, I would say. You know, even before the episode aired, it was generating a lot of controversy. The Canadian Society of Homeopaths requested their supporters to spam the CBC Marketplace comment section. What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, that seems surprising to us. You know, the story hadn't aired yet, and so I always think it's dangerous to formulate an opinion on something before you've actually heard it or watched it. And also, it seemed surprising in that they were asking us to be open-minded and to look at the research that was out there on homeopathy, but their approach to our story seemed to already have been decided that we don't like it, we know it's going to be bad, and we want to shut it down. You know, I'm sort of for freedom of speech, and I think homeopaths or whomever should be able to make their case, and journalists should be able to do their bit as well. And so I found it quite surprising and somewhat alarming that they were saying try to shut down the website.
Right. In addition to the spamming messages, they also accused CFI Canada of being in the pocket of, quote, Big Pharma. Did they accuse CBC and Marketplace of being in the pocket of anybody?
Yes, we were accused of being in the pocket of Big Pharma as well. There were some emails posted on our website saying, I've done research and I know that they're getting a lot of money. Of course, patently false. There really is no vested interest behind this story. You know, I personally, our show does not benefit if we criticize homeopathic medicine or if we herald it as the greatest thing since sliced bread. I have no axe to grind. People said clearly we decided that we didn't like homeopathy and we were just doing this because we're funded by the drug companies. Just absolutely not the case. It's nonsense to suggest that. And if you watch Marketplace, you know that we also do stories on Big Pharma. So, you know, we like to have a mix. We have no ties. We just want to reveal wrongdoing when we see it. That's our mandate, that Marketplace reveals wrongdoing and holds those accountable. So, you know, they didn't like the story, but the allegations are just incorrect.
And then the episode finally aired. And what was the response once people had seen the show?
It was quite unbelievable, actually. We had the highest viewership ever on Marketplace, 898,000 viewers. And the story went viral. It went on YouTube. We were getting emails from around the world, people both saying kudos to you for shining the light on homeopathic medicines, and other people saying, how dare you? You completely missed the point. You misinterpreted the studies. You don't get energy medicine, and so on. So a mixed reaction, but overwhelmingly critical, I would say, from members of the homeopathic community and others who support homeopathy. But just we've never seen so much reaction to a Marketplace story. It was unbelievable.
I noticed that on the comment section, there were over 800 for the episode Cure or Con. How does this compare? I mean, is it even close to anything you've ever done before on Marketplace?
Well, actually, that number has gone up to 1,600 on our website. And then CBC.ca, we did a news version, a two-minute story on the National, and they received another 400 comments. So far, we've received 2,000 emails, and we've actually had to shut down the comment section on our website because we just can't handle it. You know, we have a weekly show. We have one web guy, and you know, we read all of the emails before we post them just to make sure that they're appropriate in terms of not being racist or et cetera, not offending anyone. You know, we put up pros and cons, lots of negative emails as well, but they all have to be read before they're posted. So it was an avalanche of reaction, and it's you know, a lot of work for the show, but it's very exciting too, just to see that this dialogue is engaged and that people are sort of fighting for both sides. I mean, it's great that we've been a little part of a big discussion on homeopathy.
Mm-hmm. And in the episode in question, there are a couple of really interesting segments. At one point, you talked with a person who claimed they could cure cancer in 2 weeks with homeopathy. Why is this not considered health fraud?
Because she's not registered as a medical doctor. So we inquired about that, and a homeopath can make these claims. Your neighbor could make these claims. Somebody could be charged for not giving good health treatment or making poor recommendations, but no, as a homeopath, there's no regulation around that. So she actually technically wasn't violating anything. Of course, it's a huge, I think, ethical issue when you are telling someone with a fatal disease that homeopathic medicines that have no evidence behind them for curing cancer will do the trick. You know, for one, no evidence of that. And the worrisome point to that is that it could delay the treatment people need to get to be cured. Now, of course, a lot of people aren't cured of cancer, and conventional medicine doesn't work all the time as well. But there is some track record behind that versus homeopathy.
Absolutely. You also suggested to a Boyon representative to put a disclaimer on their product, suggesting that there's nothing in homeopathy. How did they react to that suggestion?
Well, that was a little tongue-in-cheek. Yes, we thought that they should label their products, warning this product contains no active ingredient. What they said to us was that we missed the point, that you can't measure the active ingredient, A, because the equipment hasn't been developed yet that's sensitive enough to test it, which begs the question, how does the company know that there's enough active ingredient in there to have any effect? But also they said that homeopathy works on completely different principles than what we tested for, along the lines of water having memory, and that wasn't the test we did, therefore our test was off point and meaningless. So don't be expecting anytime soon those labels to show up on their products. But, you know, sometimes on Marketplace we do things a bit tongue-in-cheek to make a point, and we didn't really expect them to take it seriously, although I think it's a pretty valid point.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, if somebody told me that they could cure cancer in 2 weeks, I'd be pretty upset and perhaps a little taken aback myself.
Well, I did interview another homeopath who did go on camera with the Homeopathic Medical Council of Canada, and he as well claimed that he could cure cancer and had done so. And we asked to speak to some of those patients because that would be amazing news if, in fact, liver cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer had been cured through homeopathy. And at first he said, well, I can't give you my patient's contact information. And then I said, well, that's fine. You give them our contact information and just please ask them to call. And we never received a phone call. So I don't know whether the homeopath didn't pass on our information or what, but we have yet to track down someone who was cured of cancer.
Mm-hmm. And now that the episode again has aired and everybody's sort of weighing in, and more accusations have been labeled that groups like CFI are actually branches of the Communist Party. I don't know how they square that with in the pocket of Big Pharma. But they've also been very critical of Marketplace. The accusations about the show and the intentions of the people on the show have been very very personal in some cases. What's your reaction to this whole attitude that they've been presenting right now?
Yeah, they have said that we were very one-sided in our piece. And we are not the news. We're a current affairs show, and our mandate is to expose wrongdoing. So for the longest time, while we're in the preliminary stages of researching something, we have no point of view. But when we decide it's a story for Marketplace, we have decided that there's enough wrongdoing that it warrants a national story. So, yes, we did decide that we were going to explore homeopathy, and the critics didn't like what we found, but we certainly didn't taint or slant any of our evidence. We didn't hide studies that we came across that might not have proven our thesis. As I mentioned, there really is nothing in it for us to try to slam homeopathy. We benefit in no way. Where I think the argument falls down, that we only present a one-sided stories, we asked repeatedly to speak to experts, to be provided evidence to the contrary of the thesis. At one point, several people said, you must talk to a particular researcher / homeopath in Toronto. And when our researcher called him, he said, well, our fingers are crossed. You know, we're holding our breath waiting for the science that will prove what we know to be true. And so we decided not to interview him, because if he's only going to say we're holding our breath, he's not providing the evidence that we were looking for. So, you know, until such time that we're provided that evidence, we're going to report what we have found to be the facts. And in fact, our show was contacted by James Randi. You probably know him. He's posted a $1 million reward for anyone who can prove scientifically that homeopathy works. And he contacted our show and said, hey, my $1 million still stands. And so far, there have been no takers.
Compared to other things that Marketplace has investigated, where does homeopathy stack up in terms of other frauds or scams or health, other dubious health products?
You know, we didn't call homeopathy a fraud or a scam because legally that suggests intent, that homeopaths are willingly, purposefully, knowingly misleading people with their medicines. And in our view, the homeopaths we spoke to are very committed to what they're doing, and they seem very truthful, and that they truly believe what they are practicing will benefit people's health. So I wouldn't call homeopathy a scam or a fraud. I would just say that it's extremely misleading to people. And I think some homeopaths' excitement and passion for their craft can transfer to their clients so that they think that this is credible and they don't understand that the science just doesn't exist behind it. You know, it's a shame that people are being misled, but I can't say that that's happening on purpose.
Interesting. You know, to many skeptics, we often see news stories try to create sort of two sides to an issue, which works for political or social issues. But when it comes to science, there isn't usually two sides. So it was very refreshing to see that Marketplace didn't try to manufacture a controversy that way. Was that a conscious decision going into the show, or was that just where the evidence led you?
No, that was where the evidence led us. We have had numerous long, difficult conversations about our piece and how we were going to present it. And it became clear along the road that there was going to be an avalanche of opposition against this piece. But no, you know, at no point did we say, well, if we get the other side, we won't present it. The reason you didn't hear any credible argument or defense for homeopathy is because we couldn't find any. We couldn't find anyone who could articulate it. Those who said they could articulate it actually couldn't. Some of the things in our program I thought were quite shocking. The largest manufacturer of homeopathic medicines saying, well, homeopathy is a mystery, but we know it works. You know, this is something you are asking people to not only spend their money on, but to invest their trust and often their health. You know, they're putting that in the hands of homeopaths. And for the largest manufacturer to say, well, it's a mystery, gee shucks, all we know is it works. I don't think that that's acceptable. Of course, there is the placebo effect. And so there's no doubt that some people who use homeopathic medicines do get better. But there's no scientific explanation for that other than it being a placebo. And so you can't make other claims anything other than that until we see the research behind that supports it.
Right, definitely. To close out, you mentioned how this was one of the highest rated episodes of Marketplace, and it was all around controversial, successful. Does this indicate that perhaps Marketplace and the CBC plan to tackle other science or pseudoscience issues as well?
Well, we like to hope we're not too ratings-driven, but, you know, we're certainly always open to looking at claims that we think are misleading to people. In the past, our show has looked at energy medicine, at bracelets that claim they send out rays that heal. We investigated something called the EPFX not too long ago that was also energy medicine. So, you know, the sad thing is there are a lot of areas that can be explored that just don't stand up to scientifically rigorous testing. But yeah, you know, certainly I think it has shown us that there's an appetite for this exploration, and it's something that we would be, I think, interested in pursuing more. I wouldn't say that we developed a lot of fans through our coverage of homeopathy, but it, you know, it's relevant. What we learned was that people care about homeopathic medicines and they care about alternative forms of healthcare. And so we are discussing whether there are other topics that we should be covering in seasons to come, for sure.
Excellent. Well, Erica, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker, and keep up the great work on Marketplace.
Thanks so much. Nice to talk to you.
It'll be a hot time in the Old Chapel on Saturday night, January 29th. It's the first annual Barn Burner Benefit, Vancouver's greasy rock and roll, rhythm and blues, and country review. Please join me, Bobby the Badger Ferris, host of the Barn Burner, for a night of honky-tonk and rock and roll mischief. This show takes place at Vancouver's newest and most unique venue, Chapel Arts, in the downtown east side at 304 Dunleavy Avenue, just one block north of the Patricia Hotel. The Barn Burner Benefit features the stunning lineup of Shiloh Lindsay, Rodney DeCrew and his new Convictions, and Minto. It's three headliners for the price of one. And the majority of the proceeds will be going to the greatest radio station on the planet, CITR 101.9 FM, and the greatest new venue in Vancouver, the Chapel Arts Gallery. Put on your boots and show your support to ensure that local artists and venues can continue to thrive in our fair city. In addition to the great acts playing, the night will also include a clothing raffle from Lifetime Collective, greasy cuisine, spaghetti westerns in the Galleria, and I'll be spinning the greasiest tracks between bands and after the show. Again, that's Saturday night, January 29th, 2011, at the Chapel Arts Gallery at 304 Dunleavy Avenue. $12 at the door, with doors opening at 8 p.m. There's no dress code, but denim on denim is probably advisable. The first annual Barn Burner Benefit, brought to you by Chapel Arts and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So our thanks go to Erica for joining us from Marketplace for talking about this really interesting controversy that they helped create.
Yes, you know, and in fact, we should just prove how wrong homeopathy is by watching that show over and over and over again and just showing how stronger and stronger the message gets.
Yes, we should do that.
Yes.
I encourage you to go online if you haven't already and check out CBC's Marketplace episode. It was really interesting, and I was in it. Yay! Well, we're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. I have a good one here. It's called Skeptics in the Pub, and it's happening in Richmond Thursday, January 27th at 7:30, Legends Pub, which is in Richmond, of course. Only a few minutes away from the Brighouse SkyTrain station, so come on down, join us for a few drinks and some food. It's at 7:30, and you really can't go wrong. Later in the week, we have a CFI lecture entitled Does God Hate Women? Presented by Ophelia Benson on Friday, January 28th at 7 p.m. here at UBC in room Buchanan A102. Should be a fantastic lecture. I look forward to learning the truth.
Maybe Pope John Paul will have a second miracle and the Pope will show up for it.
Yes, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
I have a few things. First of all, to all of my Scottish Highlander-type friends, happy Robbie Burns Day. Today's 25th of January, which is Robbie Burns Day. For those people who don't know Robbie Burns, you do know some of this stuff outside of being a 18th century poet and all-around great guy, or at least artistically speaking. Have you ever heard the song Auld Lang Syne?
Old what?
Auld Lang Syne.
No, I haven't.
Should old acquaintance be forgot?
No, I never heard this song before in my life.
Yeah, well, okay. So Robbie Burns helped make that popular. I don't think he actually wrote it. I think it was just a classic Highland song, but he kind of brought it into the forefront. So outside of that part, there are two movies that I'm keeping my eyes open for. One I've downloaded and going to watch, and I may do a segment on it if it's worth it. It's Zeitgeist 3, that wonderful Zeitgeist. It just refuses to go away. Their new movie called Moving Forward was premiered in Vancouver about 2 weeks ago. So I'm going to look at it and see whether the Zeitgeist movement has improved at all ever since the Zeitgeist movement had took it over from the original guy, because Zeitgeist, the original movie, was largely a nut job. But then there's been this whole, we can change the world, kind of like with our future of food thing, you know, if we just need technology, we'll solve all our problems. So I'm curious to see where they're going to go with it. Probably sad, I am sure. Mm-hmm. And there's another movie out that I just heard about called Hot Coffee. Now, a lot of you may remember in the past, there was this big kind of joke going around about a woman who sued McDonald's because her coffee was too hot. Well, this is kind of a movie, a bit about her case, and a bit about how tort law or civil law has been manipulated by various power brokers and all that. Because apparently, with her particular case, everyone said, oh, she got burnt with coffee. Well, she actually got third-degree burns over 16% of her body, and the coffee was so hot, one of the reasons why it spilled is it actually melted the cup that it was in.
Hmm.
So, anyhow, That was released this week, and if you search the internet, I'm sure you can find it somewhere, and it might be something worth watching. Hopefully it'll be a fair and reasonably biased, unbiased point of view, but interesting nonetheless. So that's what I'm doing this weekend, and I hope all of you have fun this weekend, sending us all of your comments. And remember, we've still got a casting call for people who want to be on our show, either for a segment or maybe for longer, or have show ideas, and you can email that to radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And I guess anything else, Ethan? You're looking at me.
Well, you know what? Done? We should mention that the subject of homeopathy came up, and 1023 is happening again on February 5th. And, of course, we here in Vancouver will be doing something special for it, so stay tuned for that. We'll have lots of information coming down the grapevine on that, and you can catch it all on www.radiofreethinker.com, where you can download our show notes, the podcast, and get all the groovy information about what we do here on the show. Well, we are right out of time, so I'd like to sign off and say this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And we'll see you next week, folks.
Bye.
UBC Stand invites you to the